would like to open with my sincerest thanks to Susan and Tamsin for organizing this wonderful event and to all of you for being present today. It's indeed an honor to be here, and I am extraordinarily pleased to be in your presence and talk with you today about the Cherokee manuscript archive that I've been working on. This talk today is dedicated to Duane King, beloved man, who is the director of the Helmerich Center for American Research. Very good man. Osion Nagada Taniche Salol Dawadoa Chalagi Chichalagi Egeya Yoneg Dawadoa Ellen Cushman Digade Yo Husky Northeastern Wagala Wadia Didagelo Washti. How many of you have ever heard the Cherokee language spoken? One, two, three, four, five. Wonderful. That's actually more than any other audience. So fantastic. That's great. Good numbers. I'm very pleased to hear that. What you just saw was a very brief snippet of what has taken me about 10 years to learn. My mother was a non, she did not speak Cherokee, but her father had a few words left. Her grandfather was fluent. And part of my work today, and as always, has been to try to help my tribe persevere in these efforts, these language efforts that are so very crucial to our tribe and to so many tribes. And what I'd like to do today is speak with you about the four tenets of the decolonial archive that I believe to be completely in line with the types of work that we're imagining here in our earlier panels. As one small part of the collective efforts of digital humanist archives, libraries, and indigenous communities, I'll briefly introduce my work in recent years before describing in more detail the work that I'm currently doing to help promote collective documentation and translation of digitally archived Cherokee language manuscripts. My hope is that the results of this work will forward the ongoing indigenous language perseverance efforts underway across the three federally recognized nations of the Cherokee people, and more broadly to the perseverance of indigenous language, generally speaking. As Peter has mentioned, I'm a literacy scholar, and my home discipline is rhetoric and writing within English studies. My research and scholarship centers on the ways in which people use oral and literate tools to persevere in oftentimes asymmetrical social relationships. My most recent work focuses on the Cherokee syllabary in order to demonstrate the cultural, linguistic, and historical importance of this writing system for our people. It was invented by a Cherokee man named Sequoia, and the Cherokee syllabary is an 86-character writing system that was adopted by our people in 1821. Within the span of 3 to 5 years, the Cherokee people learned to read and write in the Cherokee language without print or mass education. Now, just sit on that for just 1 second. That's an 86-character writing system that spread all across the eastern seaboard and all the way into the Arkansas area, what is today Arkansas. Without print or mass education, we learned to read and write in our writing system. And my curiosity was piqued by that because it's so rare to see such a wildfire spread of a language in that way, especially with an 86-character writing system. And my thought was, well, what was the heuristic value behind that? How did that happen? And if we could learn that today, if we could learn the teaching mechanism implicit in this writing system, could we persevere in our own language? Maybe. I hoped so. And so I set about writing the Cherokee syllabary, which is based on 6 years of decolonial ethnohistorical research with my tribe, the Cherokee Nation. Decolonial methodologies in indigenous communities include, among other methods, reciprocity, participant action, participatory action research, and understanding one's place as a learner. Over the course of my research, I served 3 years as a Cherokee Nation Sequoia Commissioner and as a consultant to the Johnson O'Malley Educational Programs. And in these roles, I taught youths and teens in summer programs in the nation, as well as served as a team leader and project manager in a nationwide curricular development project. As part of my consulting work with the Cherokee Nation Johnson O'Malley program, I was asked to organize a team of Cherokee scholars that included Tom Holm, Les Hanna, Catherine England, and Chris Tutom to help develop a curriculum based on the teachings of a selection of our Cherokee wampum belts. When one of the wampum belts was unethically obtained by a national museum, our elders decided to stop reading them at our stomp grounds and have since kept them in secret locations. The Cherokee Nation thought it was important to continue the teachings in these wampum belts, and they decided to write a curriculum based on these. In helping in these efforts, I understood the activist work necessary in telling stories as a central facet of persevering in Indigenous languages. Regardless of the material artifacts that prompt stories, be they wampum belts, manuscripts, and digital archives, or social networking sites, decolonizing the archive begins with attention to the ways in which archives were imperialist creations to begin with. So as soon as the word archive is used, it evokes four imperialist tenets of thought. And I talk a little bit about this in this article in College English that came out in 2013. Those tenets of imperialist thought are tradition, collection, artifacts, and preservation, words we've heard already used today. These tenets of imperialist thought structure archives, whether in material or digital forms. This idea of tradition as a singular concept was created under the framing narrative of linear time. In other words, Western thinking created its own singular tradition by pointing to itself along a time-hatched mark within and against a plurality of traditions. Often organized by Western notions of time, archives and museums train their visitors to be epistemologically obedient to Western modernity's concept of tradition. So in the first move of decolonizing the archive, it's to challenge those Western understandings of time as a necessary underpinning for tradition. And if that's the first move, the second move takes up the problem of collecting artifacts. The actions involved in collection of artifacts damage them in three ways. The item is taken from its context of use, as we heard about with the wampum belt. It's no longer understood in its relation to the stories that place them in its context and its relation to the people who use it. Our wampum belts were read at our stomp grounds, one of our ceremonial spaces. The people who would ostensibly have use for these items are necessarily presumed to be no longer living. And we still practice our stomps, we were reading these belts up until the 1980s. The third move in decolonizing the archive emerges directly from the second when trying to understand how these artifacts then work to mediate knowledge for the people who use them. What does this object mean for the people who use it? And even though it seems that a collector has succeeded in obtaining a Cherokee wampum belt, that person is not likely to know how to read it or what it means to the Cherokee people. The Cherokee word for wampum belts, dekanui, means roughly to look this way or to look toward. And because they are lived, spoken, read, enacted, and taught, and because they provide a history or a way to look toward for our people, they represent our continued survival as a tribe. They were essentially the material artifacts of our own historical curriculums that we would teach at our stomp grounds. The meanings of these belts, then, is both a highly symbolic and highly valued pedagogical text. It was used as a mnemonic device that prompted the recall and telling of stories that helped us enunciate our knowledge. So that brings me to the fourth and final move that would be necessary to decolonize the archives with a digital archive, and that would be Indigenous languages, particularly decolonial translation methods. And so I'm going to talk a little bit more about these now that I've brought you through the history of the project, bringing us up to the present. So two questions basically emerge for those of us interested in building decolonial digital archives. How can digital libraries, scholars, and Indigenous communities advance a decolonial vision of society together? We've heard a little bit of the really great work of archives working together and museums working together this morning. This is precisely the kind of thing that we would like to see happen with tribal communities as well. A vision of this begins with the epistemologies of people, what Jack mentioned earlier being the epistemological turning over that he talked about from the first panel, and it strikes me that something can be said here for the important decolonial work at the Dartmouth Libraries and the Special Collections developing the Occam Digital Archive, as well as we see some of this work happening at Yale University and their Transcribe Yale project. We're on a good path of working together, and that's to be certain, and we are witnessing important advances in the creation of protocols for working with Indigenous communities to identify culturally sensitive materials and to develop collaborative methods with communities to select appropriate metadata categories for library materials. And there I'm drawing on a very important line of research from Amy Lone Tree and Jennifer Neo and Tim Powell, who used to be at the American Philosophical Society. So a really important step, then, in decolonizing the archive is for us to de-link from the imperial legacy of translation and develop the decolonial translation methods and practices. That kind of builds on all of the work of the methodology of first gathering Indian people's interests together around these manuscripts so that we can begin to restore our media and our manuscripts, to replace them, to find the meaning behind them, and so that we can have linguistic perseverance. And notice the difference there between preservation and perseverance. We are still here, and we are persevering, and we'd like your help. This is a little joke. I know it's kind of a heavy talk, but it's going to get lighter in just a second. So with the help of the Institute of Museum and Library Services Spark Ignition Grant, a team of colleagues and I from Michigan State University developed a American Indian Language Manuscript Translation Project, and we are hoping to innovate technology to create a collective space for the translation of native language manuscripts. We have tribal citizen scholars on our advisory board. We have representatives from the Cherokee Nation and White Earth Chippewa Tribe of Minnesota. We have developed a prototype of a graphical user interface for this digital archive. And this space would create a collaboratively authored, tribally based online location for us to work together with librarians and scholars to develop, refine, and persevere in our translations of Cherokee and Anishinaabemowin language manuscripts from repositories around the country, which is very exciting. Our team has explored methods of selecting and translating these manuscripts that respond to the complex need of these constituencies of our entire tribally based language translation teams in particular. We went on the ground and asked them, how is it that you're doing your translation in your day-to-day work, and can we build a site based on that? And I'm going to show you a few of the pages on that. So the first stage of our project then includes the creation of this digital repository of linked manuscripts. There are thousands of Cherokee language manuscripts in archives and libraries around the country. Thousands. Handwritten manuscripts in the Cherokee syllabary. And even more in Anishinaabemowin writing systems. There are several governing that, which is very thorny in and of itself. But our second stage, and this is where it gets really exciting, is once we have this built and we have all of our agreements made where everybody can create this translation space together, we build in the intergenerational learning of that translation practice and our language perseverance. So basically, what we would do is create this dashboard where anybody can go in among our partners and import manuscripts, and it gives you a sense of how these have been completed. I think this will allow me to point, does it? Yes. So here you can see how much of the translation has been completed and what the title of the particular manuscript is. And then it will allow you to take a look at the archives all around the country that have already partnered with us and allow you to build your own kind of archive for manuscripts that you would like to translate. And so you can see a little bit of the number of the libraries that have begun to partner with us. We hope to add quite a few more, we're getting there. Collections and the manuscript title and the select the title of the particular manuscript, and you're building this in either Cherokee or right now Ojibwa. We decided to mock it up according to two language families. Our thinking is if we can have a proof of concept for two different language families, the good news is that we would be able to launch this or scale this outward for most native languages. They're very complex, but Iroquois and the Anishinaabemowin language, language families would be a really great instantiation of this. This particular page then would allow us to enter metadata that's culturally appropriate, and all of our manuscripts would be selected from ones that our tribes have vetted, either with the archives themselves or with ourselves if they are our own manuscripts. But the nice point of that is that we're not going to be translating any culturally sensitive materials, essentially, and making them public. We would then have a translation space, and we would allow to see who is the history of those particular translators and then the sources of the particular document itself. We're also developing an interlineal translation, and that's actually really, really key for how it is that this would work out. And I say that because translation itself is not an innocent project. So even though we can build this graphical user interface with lots of collaboration and reciprocity, our next goal is to think about this. What are the hermeneutics of doing decolonial translation? And the problem with translation, as we've seen across the centuries, is that oftentimes knowledge is put into and on the terms of people who are outsiders in order to create a singular tradition or a set of traditions that are kind of objectified as exotic and unique. And that's not at all what we're after. We're actually for a much more complicated process that allows us to translate in ways that avoid the kinds of processes, the strategies of containment that we've seen in other places. And I had two particular instances of where that translation has been an imperial process, but for the sake of time, and because I know I might be running a little bit over, I'm okay? Okay. Well, let me give you just two very brief instances of why translation matters to the Cherokee people, because there were two. And the first one has to do with the ways in which the Bible was translated for our people to civilize the Cherokee people, essentially. In that first moment, the Bible was brought into Cherokee first by John Pickering, who created an orthography to represent all American Indian languages. Orthographies being writing systems. This one was alphabetic-based, and it was rejected by our nation's council, our tribal council, and we said, no, we want the Bible to be in the Cherokee syllabary, which is why we have the Bible written, the New Testament, in the Cherokee syllabary, and that's a really important thing because the word for God in Cherokee, une klanahi, une klanahi, isn't that beautiful? Just love it. Une klanahi means provider, or quite literally, if you were to translate it morpheme by morpheme, he, she, or it provides everything for us all. Now imagine that. He, she, or it provides everything for us all. That's a very different conception of God than the Western understanding of God, right? So every time we say God in the Cherokee New Testament, we're actually bringing the Christian epistemology into and on our terms. Very interesting. So we rejected the American Board of Foreign Commissioners' efforts through both Samuel Worcester, who was very interested in translating that and helping us translate that in the Cherokee syllabary. We rejected their initial impulse to work with John Pickering to translate that into an alphabetic orthography. Perseverance. But we also see this impulse, the imperial process of translation, from anthropologists. And here's kind of a unique case, which I found really, really interesting, and how it is that James Mooney created this rationale for his anthropological study of Cherokee. And I have to tell you that James Mooney has been very, very helpful to Cherokee in so many respects, and he's very well respected among our peoples. But when you look at the introduction, he says of his Myths of the Cherokee, he says that he sets his sight on the remote Carolina hills where, quote, the ancient things have been preserved, rather than, rather than studying Western Cherokee who are so far advanced along the white man's road as to offer but little inducement for ethnographic study. Mooney hoped to show the clearly visible differences of Cherokees in the Carolinas. He was exoticizing them and saying that they were clearly very different from those civilized Cherokee in the West who had their printing press and their thousands of pages of Cherokee language. And he kind of totalizes the reality of Western man by translating the knowledge of the Cherokees in North Carolina into English And he did this in part because of the greater difference from the white man's ways. And so that was one very, really interesting instance of an imperial impulse in translation. But those two instances of translation and of Cherokee knowledge into and on Western terms illustrates that subtler point about language itself as a medium of translation and why it matters if it's in Cherokee or English. The target audience and the purpose and the desired outcome of a translation process are what matter most. In either direction we go, be it James Mooning translating the work of the Cherokee's stories into his own manuscripts, or the Bible being translated into Cherokee, it didn't really matter what the target language was. On the one hand, the containment of the Cherokee ceremonial knowledge into Christian theology with the translation of the Bible, and on the other hand, the containment of the Cherokee stories into myths and legends, which isn't really knowledge, but quaint traditions. Regardless of that direction that the translation went, it served to enunciate Western theologies and knowledges couched in narratives of conversion and representations of primitive people. So translation itself is not a simple project, and it's quite where we're at when we look at how we build and what's going to happen within the pages that we are actually able to build in this digital archive. And so the imperative for decolonial translation processes and practices then is to consider how it is that we can work together to translate these Cherokee language manuscripts in ways that create alternatives to that imperial legacy of translation. Here are some of the methodological assumptions that we're working with. And as a kind of a quasi-social scientist myself, I really appreciate methodological assumptions and having clarity in them, in part because they give you a sense of how we're working a little bit differently together to create knowledge, and our understanding of our lives as being connected together, and how it is that we're going to be working from these grounded positionalities to create a more inclusive understanding of multiple peoplehoods, hopefully, in this archive. We work from this ethics of pluriversality and inclusivity. Some of those we've begun to hear a little bit in Jeanette's opening about communities, but a notion of peoplehood really helps us understand how it is that those knowledges and languages engender very different ways of thinking and being in the world. All of this is to say we enter into a delinking process, especially an epistemological delinking process that allows us to begin to think where it is that we are as opposed to impose our own knowledges. And all of that has implication, it is, for decolonial archives themselves. So four of them in particular. The materiality and mediation of knowledge matters a great deal to the people who have written these manuscripts, to the people who want to use these manuscripts to persevere in our language efforts, and to the ways in which our wampum belts were originally procured in the first place. Acknowledging how it is that knowledge is enunciated, on whose terms, and using what sign tools is a matter of great importance that should not be taken for granted when it comes to the actual translation of these manuscripts. The exploration of the relationships is so very necessary as well, because we have to be working together with our tribal peoples, librarians, scholars, linguists, all of us coming together, none of us privileging our own knowledges above others, which is very, very difficult to find collaborators willing to equalize knowledge bases that way. But it gives us hope, and it gives us an understanding and a practice of creating knowledge in pluriversal and collaborative ways for a 21st century university. It's no longer about the universal or the university, but a pluriversity, where multiple knowledges matter, where institutional, linguistic, social, epistemic hierarchies can be equalized, and where many peoples and their knowledges can come together and find ways of living in and on their own terms. And they do so by relocating, replacing, and re-relating knowledges. So the implications of building these archives are fairly astounding when you think of how it could do business a little bit differently in this world. I leave you with one more Cherokee word, wado, which is thanks.